Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Move over, Captain America. The man facing 4 indictments and 80-plus charges wants you to believe he's the candidate that will be toughest on crime. And yet, part of his grand plan includes freeing violent criminals. But as he falsely claims crime is worse than ever, it's worth taking a closer look at what's really going on. I'll talk about it with former Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano. Speaking of Trump's legal troubles, with just 8 days to go from the expected start of his criminal trial in New York, Trump's attorneys are now asking the judge to recuse himself. Our in-house law firm is here to break down his latest delay tactic. Plus, as President Biden visits the scene of the collapsed Key Bridge in Baltimore and honors the victims killed, Donald Trump still has not weighed in on it. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg joins me ahead to talk about the bizarre reaction we have seen from some on the right. Okay, so if elected, Donald Trump wants to exact revenge, become a dictator on day one, stay out of prison, of course, and apparently fight crime.
New York City is a crime den. Chicago is a crime den.
Crime is rampant, by the way.
Killings are taking place at a number like nobody's ever seen.
Crime is rampant and out of control like never, ever before. You have vicious crimes, you have violent crimes, you have all these.
You take a look at your cities are going to hell.
We have to get law and order back.
We have to get back to law and order.
We will restore law and order to our country.
Wouldn't we love to have a statistic where crime is down 67%? Ours is only going in one direction.
So here's the thing. In most places, it's going in the opposite direction. New data shows that murder is down an average of 20% across 180 cities so far this year. And that follows data from the FBI showing that reported violent crime dropped 6% across the board from 2022 to 2023. Of course, with crime statistics come caveats. Of course there are. Not every crime is reported. Not every community is experiencing a drop-off in crime at all. I mean, right here in Washington, D.C., where I'm sitting right now, while murder is down about 30% so far this year, 2023 was the city's deadliest year in decades. So this is not to suggest crime is not a problem at all. It is just not a problem in the way that Donald Trump says it is. And the more you dig into all the data, the more egregious his lies become. For example, Trump says crime is surging in big cities. He says it a lot. In reality, violent crime dropped in cities with populations over 1%, over 1 million by 11%. Trump often calls out rampant crime in New York City specifically. In reality, major crime has plummeted there by more than 75% over the past 30 years. And it's even down this year, over the last year. Trump also claims, I mean, he claims this a lot, that he would be tougher on crime than President Joe Biden. In reality, Trump's last budget, from when he was president, when he was doing budgets, actually proposed funding cuts for local law enforcement. You could say that's literally trying to defund the police. You could say that. Well, President Biden has consistently, in all of his budgets, proposed far more in funding. And Trump, of course, claims all the time that he will restore law and order. You just heard over and over and over again in that clip, which is pretty rich, considering Trump is also telling us that one of his highest priorities on day one is actually releasing criminals from prison. Namely, these people. The people who stormed the U.S. Capitol, who infiltrated the hallways of chambers of commerce, who made lawmakers fear for their lives, and who tried to stop the peaceful transfer of power by force. He wants to release the people who violently assaulted police officers with bats, clubs, pepper spray, flagpoles, and fire extinguishers, leading to concussions, cracked ribs, and other severe injuries. People like Daniel Ball, who threw an explosive device into a tunnel of officers who were fighting to hold back the mob. Or Edward Kelly, who was charged with plotting to murder FBI employees after his initial release on January 6 charges, or Taylor Toronto, who later showed up outside Barack Obama's home with guns after Trump posted his address, or Daniel Rodriguez, who drove a stun gun into the neck of former Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone. So Mr. Law and Order, as he calls himself, who has centered his reelection campaign on fear-mongering about violent crime, wants amnesty for violent criminals. That's one of his first day one priorities for the country. He says it all the time. And that fact should not be lost on the American public as they weigh their options this November. Don't just take it from me. Here's Republican strategist Karl Rove.
If they were smart, they'd take the January 6th and go hard at it. And they would say, he wants to pardon these people who attacked our Capitol. I worked in that building as a young man. To me, the Congress of the United States is one of the great examples of the strength of our democracy and a jewel of the Constitution. And what those people did when they violently attacked the Capitol in order to stop a constitutionally mandated meeting of the Congress to accept the results of the Electoral College is a stain on our history. And every one of those sons of who did that, we ought to find them, try them, and send them to jail. And one of the critical mistakes made in this campaign is that Donald Trump has now said, I'm going to pardon those people because they're hostages. No, they're not. They're thugs.
Joining me now is former Secretary of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama, Janet Napolitano. She's also the founding faculty member of the Berkeley Center for Security and Politics. And Secretary Napolitano, thank you so much for taking the time. And I want to start by saying facts are so important here. And that's so important to dig into. And that's one of the reasons I really am excited to talk to you this afternoon. I mean, I just debunk some of the things Trump is pushing about crime. He says crime is worse than ever when in most places in the U.S. is actually going down. It is going up in some places. It has in Washington, D.C. over the last year, but it's gone down a little recently. You served, of course, as Homeland Security Secretary, and I want your take on this as well. What are you seeing when it comes to crime trends right now? Where is it actually down? Where are there still places that are concerning?
So, first of all, for former President Trump to run as a so-called law and order candidate, it would be like me saying I play in the NBA. I mean, it just doesn't hold true. Yeah. So, look, there was a terrific spike in violent crime, really during the end of the Trump presidency when we were in the midst of the COVID pandemic. But since then, crime has been coming down in some years dramatically. So last year, 2023 saw the largest 1 year decrease in violent crime nationwide than we've had since around 1960. And so to say that we are awash in violent crime, that it's going up, et cetera, look, never let the facts get in the way of rhetoric, I guess, but the facts are the facts.
No question. So why it's so important to discuss them? There are, and I want to talk about migrant crime specifically, because you have had done many things in your career. You were also a former governor of a border state. And there have been heartbreaking stories like that of Lake and Riley. Republicans have been pushing that as evidence that migrant crime is a major driver of crime. There are tragic cases, but let's talk about that specifically and what the facts are actually here on migrant crime.
So, look, making an overall argument about crime from one terrible case, and it's a terrible case, and my heart goes out to the family and to the friends of the victim. But to make an overall national argument that we are awash in violent crime caused by migrants, again, just doesn't comply with the facts. There have been dozens of studies done that show that migrants in the United States, those born outside the United States who now live here, actually commit crime at lower rates than native-born Americans. So, the data is very clear on this score, and it can't be repeated enough.
I agree. Absolutely. It's important people understand the details here. The thing is, and you obviously run for office, and in addition to doing all these things, I mean, despite what the data shows, which we've been talking about, the fact that crime is going down in most places is not registering with the public. I mean, a Gallup poll from this fall found that 77% of Americans believe crime rates are worsening. I mean, I have my own views on why this is, why that statistic is the case. But what do you think? Why is it not registering with the public?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is you never see the press covering a crime that didn't occur. The only thing that's going to get covered is, you know, when there is a homicide, when there is an armed robbery. You're not going to see a lead story on the local news saying Walgreens wasn't shoplifted today. So part of it is just the media environment in which crime sits. You only cover it when it happens. And I think that's a big part of it, because, as you know, in politics, perception becomes reality and the media helps create the perception. And when you have a leading candidate for president just repeating it and repeating it, no matter how inaccurate it is, that just reinforces it.
No question about it. And I did want to add, I mean, the FBI, as you know, currently ranks domestic political terrorism as a top threat in the country. And as you well know, I mean, they take these things seriously. They look at all the data. And as you just referenced, I mean, this is all coming at a time when the presumptive Republican nominee, four times indicted Donald Trump, has repeatedly threatened judges, their family members, prosecutors, elected officials. I mean, I can go on. But from a law enforcement perspective, how much do you think his rhetoric is to blame for this and people who are copying his rhetoric?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. And, you know, for whatever reason, and there are many, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't explain it. But many people believe in what Donald Trump says, and despite the data, despite the facts, despite that the January 6th people who have been convicted or who have pled guilty were criminals. For once, I agree with Karl Rove. They're thugs. You know, they attacked law enforcement. They attacked law enforcement officers. They disrupted the Congress of the United States. They treated our leading institution in the Capitol with utmost disrespect. They're not patriots. They're not hostages. You know, they are legitimately, with all due process rights ascribed to them, convicted of crimes. And now they have to serve their punishment. To me, that's what law and order means.
Absolutely. I do want to play. We played some of what Karl Rove had to say. It's important to remind people he was a top advisor to George W. Bush. I mean, this is not a Democrat, far from it. But I want to play another part of what he had to say and get your reaction to it.
To me, it is a mistake on the part of the Trump campaign to allow the president's impulses to identify himself with the people who assaulted the Capitol rather than people who stand for law and order. Yeah.
This seems pretty clear to me. I mean, and it is Trump running, as you said earlier, as the law and order candidate is ludicrous, given his record. What should Democrats be saying about this? What would you advise people to be calling? How should they be calling this out?
Well, first of all, just lay out that we are in the midst of a national record decrease in violent crime. So what's wrong with that? And look, more work needs to be done. We don't want any violent crime. And there are certain pockets in the country where the national trend hasn't held. More targeting and work needs to be done in those communities. So let's acknowledge that this is a project that in a way never ends. But to have someone say and position themselves as a law and order candidate when he himself is the subject of four criminal indictments, 90 some odd counts of serious felony charges, what do you do? I'm going to quote Monty Python. I scoff in your general direction. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
I mean, no better way to end than on a Monty Python quote. Secretary Napolitano, thank you so much for joining us. So many facts, so many details. Real pleasure talking to you this afternoon. And next, if I had to guess, Donald Trump has a pretty busy 8 days ahead of him, for him as he prepares for his first criminal trial in the hush money case. It's slated to start a week from tomorrow, despite Trump's best efforts to recuse Judge Juan Merchan for a second time. The law firm is here to help us figure out what we should all be paying attention to in the case.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. the I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake, let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. King's Island is now open weekends.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
After a quick break. On Friday, Donald Trump and his lawyers filed a motion asking the judge overseeing his criminal fraud trial in New York to recuse himself from the case. They're accusing the judge of political bias and impropriety, recycling similar claims about the Judge Merchan's daughter that were already rejected in August. It's basically a last-ditch attempt by Trump to delay his court proceedings, we've seen this before, which are set to begin in just 8 days. So as we all prepare for the first criminal trial of a former president in U.S. history, it's important to take a moment to remind ourselves what exactly this is all about. I mean, we all know Trump is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records to silence adult film actress Stormy Daniels. That's why we often call it the hush money case. But as salacious as that sounds, it's not just about how Trump covered up his alleged affair, it's about why. So let's rewind just for a second the clock back to October of 2016 and the release of that infamous, horrible Access Hollywood tape. I mean, he was widely condemned in response to that by members of his own party. Trump was. Some even pulled their endorsements, and several even called on him to drop out in the immediate aftermath. Had the Daniels story gone public at that time, her revelations certainly could have further damaged Trump's candidacy. So the scheme to pay for her silence and cover it up wasn't just intended to save Trump from some personal embarrassment. It wasn't just that. The purpose, as the indictment makes clear, was to hide damaging information from the voting public. That's important to remember. Join me now is our in-house law firm, everyone's favorite legal eagles, Neil Katyal is the former acting U.S. Solicitor General, Andrew Weissman is the former general counsel at the FBI, and a senior member of special counsel Robert Mueller's team. So, Neil, let's just start with this latest development, shall we say, because on Friday, as I just walked through, Trump's team attempted to delay this further by accusing the judge of bias because his daughter is involved in political work. Clearly, there's not a lot of basis there or no basis. I know you and Andrew have said that. Is this just to sow doubt? What is the play here?
Right. You're absolutely right. There's no basis, Jen. And maybe let me just start by saying that as someone who actually pays his taxes, I'm glad to see April 15th actually having some consequence for Donald Trump. That'll be the day that the trial will start.
It's
I think it will start despite this last minute attempt to delay. I mean, Trump's decisions.
You don't think it will be delayed?
I don't think it's going to be delayed. I mean, Trump's decisions all throughout, his legal strategy is first lie, then deny, then delay. Mm-hmm. And we're on the delay phase of this. It's his last ditch effort to say the judge is getting, you know, kickbacks or some money from his daughter through this. It's something that's preposterous. It's something that was rejected by the New York court and the ethics committee earlier. So I think it's going nowhere. We will see that trial begin. And I strongly suspect Donald Trump will be convicted at the end of that trial. And, you know, that will be the first former president to have been convicted criminally. And it may even rethink, who knows, states to rethink their felon disenfranchisement laws.
Maybe. There's a lot to watch, which is important for people to remember. So, Andrew, you know, he's charged, as I noted in the top, of course, with falsifying business records. But we forget, this is why it was so important to walk through it, that this was to conceal his motive, which was to essentially hold back information from voters here. What do you think? I'm asking you to go a little meta here. But what do you think this tells us about kind of, I guess, I don't know if it's what he's capable of or how he might approach this moving forward?
Well, I think we saw the same strategy that he used in 2016, as alleged. We saw it in connection with the first impeachment, with his effort to get Ukraine to say that they were doing an investigation into the Bidens. Remember, that's all he cared about. He just wanted the appearance of an investigation. We then saw it in his efforts with Jeffrey Clark at the Department of Justice. He wanted them to say that there was an investigation into fraud. All of these are efforts to mislead the public in an election. I'd say the big difference between the allegations in 2016 that are going to go to trial and what mm-hmm. we're seeing now is a little bit like what you covered with Janet Napolitano. It was just the brazenness that now he's openly saying, you know what, there's no shame. I'm not going to fire a Paul Manafort because of allegations about what he did in Ukraine. In fact, I'm going to hire a felon. I'm going to run on pardoning people who have had due process, as Janet Napolitano so rightly put out. And so he's really just become much more brazen, but it is the same strategy.
Yeah, I mean, the brazenness is such a good, speaking of brazenness, I mean, he compared himself to Nelson Mandela. I mean, he, in the last 24 hours, I mean, he said he was willing to go to jail. He's, of course, attacked Judge Marchand, even despite the gag order. How does this impact? This seems almost like an obvious question, but how does this impact his case?
Right. Well, first of all, Nelson Mandela, I guess, is a step down from his earlier comparison to Jesus Christ.
It's just like yeah, you can't make it
but,
up sometimes.
But legally, none of this is going anywhere. I mean, you know, that's the beauty of the American criminal justice system. It's 12 jurors, it's, you know, rules of evidence and the like. And these kinds of nonsense arguments go nowhere. And so that's why I suspect he'll be convicted. And I suspect even despite Judge Cannon's machinations down in Florida and the stolen documents investigation, should that case go to trial, and she's trying to make it so it may not, but if it does go to trial, he's going to be convicted almost certainly there as well.
I mean, we'll see and we will watch. Okay, Andrew, we only have about a minute left, but you're a professional, and I have to ask you about Judge Cannon, because, I mean, Judge Cannon, she rejected Trump's motion to dismiss the case, but she still won't rule on Trump's false argument. It kind of leaves it hanging out there that his personal property is kind of could be part of his, you know, it doesn't violate the Presidential Records Act, I should say. If you're Jack Smith, I mean, what do you do? What can you do in this case?
I think he has to push her for a pretrial ruling. He cannot wait for this to be resolved at trial because jeopardy attaches then. So I suspect that we're going to see that continued effort to get a ruling. And then if she does not rule, I think there will be some sort of an appeal, whether it's technically called an appeal or a mandamus. I won't get into that morass. But I do think that he has to push for these pretrial rulings because of her conduct here.
Everyone's going to learn that term, so you should Google it now, because we'll, I'm sure, be talking about it soon. Neil Katyal, thank you so much. Andrew Weissman, always great to talk to you both and help us make sense of things. And next, I'll talk to the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee about just how much the humanitarian crisis inside Gaza worsened this week, following a deadly attack on aid workers from World Central Kitchen. And later, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg will be here to address the latest out of Baltimore, almost 2 weeks after that horrifying bridge collapse. I'll ask him why he thinks Trump still won't even acknowledge the tragedy. There's new reporting this weekend out about the Biden administration's growing concerns over Iran, particularly whether Iran will strike targets inside Israel in retaliation for the Israeli airstrikes in Syria this week that killed several senior Iranian officials. Now, there's no question this further complicates what is already an incredibly dire situation on the ground. Today, of course, marks 6 months since Hamas's attack on Israel. It's estimated that more than 130 Israeli hostages are still being held by Hamas, and the death toll in Gaza has now surpassed 33,000 people, two-thirds of whom are women and children. Famine now looms over the 2.2 million Palestinians in the region as well. The Secretary General of the United Nations warned again on Friday that Palestinian children are dying of starvation and dehydration. So make no mistake, the humanitarian situation on the ground in Gaza is appalling and devastating. And it was further exacerbated on Monday when 7 aid workers with the World Central Kitchen were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. That attack prompted President Biden to call Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to warn him that the United States' continued support depends on Israel implementing new steps to protect civilians and aid workers. Israel says it will open additional aid routes to Gaza and it'll increase deliveries to those in desperate need of help. That's a step forward, but far more is needed. At this point, the question is, how much aid is needed to actually stem what is a growing humanitarian crisis? What can be done to ensure it's moving forward? And joining me now is someone who knows all about this to talk through it, David Miliband. He's the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. David, I'm so grateful for you to making the time this morning. So David, I really wanted to start. I mean, we've heard a growing number of calls, which is a good thing, for more aid to get through to Gaza from a long list of world leaders, including President Biden, members of Congress. But as you know better than most, there is a massive difference between a few trucks over a few days and what is actually needed. So talk to me about what would actually be needed to address or start to address what is a devastating and growing humanitarian crisis on the ground.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, Jen. Your intro did a great job of framing the conversation. I just pick up one thing you said, though, that an announcement of new aid crossings and a new port of entry were going to improve things. No, only action will improve things. And the I would make to your viewers today and to you as well is to recognize that things have got worse, not better, over the last week in Gaza. They continue to get worse. It's now 3 weeks since an independent organization, the Independent Phase Classification System, said that 1 million people were at catastrophic levels of hunger and facing famine. That has not been rectified. And in terms of understanding the scale of this, one, it's a very imperfect metric, but one metric is that pre-October the 7th, which, as you rightly say, that was the precipitating event for this part of the conflict. It wasn't the precipitating event of the whole Israel-Palestine conflict. It was a precipitating event for this phase of conflict, this conflict. Before then, about 500 trucks of aid were going in every day. Mm-hmm. In January, we were down to 200. In February, there was even lower levels, about half the levels. And this is cumulative. Famines don't happen fast. They happen slowly. Where you have famine, you have illness. Where you have famine and illness, you have desperation. Where you have famine, illness, and desperation, you have disorder. And in Gaza, you've got that in a very tightly packed space with 2.2 million civilians. And that's why so many are at risk of death today.
I'm so glad you said action is very different from verbal commitments or promises. This is so true in global diplomacy, and it's an important thing. Actions and exponentially increasing the aid is what's so important. I do want to play for you, you know, World Central Kitchen founder Chef Jose Andres, he spoke about this morning. I wanted to play a clip for you and just get your reaction to that as well.
This is not anymore about the seven men and women of World Central Kitchen that perish on this unfortunate event. This is happening way for too long. It's been 6 months of targeting anything that seems moves. This doesn't seem a war against terror. This doesn't seem anymore a war about defending Israel. This really, at this point, seems it's a war against humanity itself.
I would note that the UN Secretary General, he's called for investigations into the deaths of all 196 aid workers. I think it's important people to know it's not just seven. They're all tragedy, all tragic, but there's additional many. What's your reaction to what he had to say? Do you agree with what he had to say?
Well, Jen, on the 18th of January, the guest house of the International Rescue Committee and our partner, Medical Aid for Palestinians, was hit by an Israeli missile. 15 people were in, three were injured. Very fortunately, none were killed. We warned at the time that the so-called deconfliction system, the system that's meant to protect humanitarian aid workers from combatants and from missiles, wasn't working. So you're absolutely right to say that this terrible incident this week is only one of many that should alert us to the need for a 180-degree turn in the way we understand the rights of civilians and of aid workers in conflict. It's not an act of beneficent generosity of combatants in conflict to allow aid through or not to kill aid workers. It's a fundamental legal right that was established after 1945. And the great danger is that we treat the access for aid workers, the flow of aid, as something that is a gift. No, it's a right, and it's been lost. And it's been lost in absolutely tragic circumstances. There are still 130 hostages, as you rightly say, 6 months since the terrible events of October the 7th. And it's absolutely vital that we understand that now is the time for action. People on the ground are in a state of absolute desperation. We have our own surgical team in one of the few hospitals that's working. We have partners trying to reach people in northern Gaza. This is a beyond desperate, and Secretary Blinken rightly called for an inflection point this week in comments on Friday. We need to see the action. It's not only up to the United States, but the U.S. has an absolutely critical role to play.
David Milban, I hope you will come back and join us and talk to us more in depth in the future. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. And coming up next, another day, another massive contrast between President Biden and Donald Trump. This time it has to do with their responses, or lack thereof, to the bridge collapse in Baltimore. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is...
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Standing by to talk about it on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. Your nation has your back. That was President Biden's message to the city of Baltimore when he visited on Friday, shown there. He toured the site of the collapsed Key Bridge, met with the families of the victims. In his remarks, Biden referred to the workers, immigrants from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, as hardworking, strong, and selfless. Biden also vowed to have the federal government fully rebuild the entire bridge. Now, in quite a contrast, Donald Trump has remained silent about Baltimore. No condolences for the victims, no statements to even acknowledge that the tragedy even occurred. And it's been about 12 days since the bridge collapsed. For someone who likes to brag about being a big builder, who has plenty to say about a lot of things, let's be honest, who is the presidential nominee for a major party, Trump's silence is not normal. I think that's important to state. And it says a lot about how he would treat tragedies in places like Baltimore. Joining me now is the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. So let me start there with this visit, because President Biden, no surprise, I think, to either of us, he exhibited a lot of empathy. Obviously, people lost their lives. People are mourning their family members there. And the president also vowed that the federal government will pay, quote, the entire cost of rebuilding it. So what does that look like?
Well, yeah, the president's responded characteristically with humanity and compassion, but also with very clear direction about what has to happen mm-hmm. next. And having sat across the desk in the Oval Office as he's grilling me and the admiral from the Coast Guard about what's next and how we can get Baltimore ready, I'll tell you, he is very, very focused on what that's going to mm-hmm. take. This is a major operation in two respects. First, getting that channel back open, which is the only way to get to most of the port of Baltimore. And then second, something that will take longer, but we need to do quickly, mm-hmm. is to get that bridge back up. Mm-hmm. That's going to take a lot of coordination. That coordination is already underway. We got $60 million out from our department within hours of getting the request mm-hmm. to get them started. But that is just a fraction of what it's going to take to replace that bridge, which is very important for traffic getting across there. Meanwhile, the race to get the port open is on pretty soon. By the end of April, we think the Army Corps will be able to get a 35-foot deep channel open. That's not the same as having it totally mm-hmm. clear, but it's an important step on the road back to normal and means more of those vessels can come through. And just as important, means more of the workers in the Port of Baltimore can be back on the job and back earning their paychecks.
Yeah, I mean, these details are so important because these are things that impact people's lives tremendously. I mean, Trump is running for president. He has yet to acknowledge the victims of the tragedy in Baltimore who were fixing the potholes on the bridge at the time of the collapse. All of them were immigrants. I have my own views, but why do you think he said absolutely nothing?
Yeah, and I'll take care to avoid talking about campaigns while I'm sitting here. But just at a human level, it would be
helpful for the former president to weigh in here and show the solidarity that we have seen from most, if not all, elected officials on either side of the aisle because of the human nature of what happened. The fact that you had, these six people mm-hmm. who lost their lives, a seventh very seriously injured, who are out there doing the work that all of us count on but don't always think about. That was a chilly night. They were out filling potholes, mending the road, getting that bridge squared away while most everybody else was sleeping so that it'd be ready for traffic in the morning. We count on so many workers in this country, many of them immigrants, to do these vitally important infrastructure jobs. They're not glamorous. They're not the highest paying jobs in the country, but they're absolutely essential. And I think just, again, at a human level, showing some regard for mm-hmm. that is very important. And that's what, characteristically, President Biden was doing when I was with him in Baltimore on Friday.
There are few people better at debunking than you, I will say. And there has been this ongoing meme or in the right wing push that this is about DEI in companies.
Yeah.
Just break down the absurdity. And why is that the message they are pushing?
You know, I think this is another one of those moments where all they have is a hammer and everything looks like a culture war. This is mm-hmm. not about women and minorities. This is about a bridge that was struck by a ship. Mm-hmm. We saw something similar with the Alaska Airlines and mm-hmm. Boeing incident. And I just don't understand the mentality of somebody who sees an issue like this mm-hmm. That was a very physical, direct infrastructure issue. And their first thought is, how can I make this about women and minorities? This is not about politics. This is not about culture wars. This is about safety. It's about transportation. It's about infrastructure. All of which, by the way, is what President Biden made a priority of when he came into office, pushing that infrastructure legislation that is about things like making sure that our bridges and, for that matter, our airports and our ports are stronger, including making them more resilient to disasters, mm-hmm. natural and man-made. There's never been funding before on a dedicated level for there to be investments in highways and bridges to make them more resilient until President Biden's infrastructure plan went through. That's what the focus ought to be. And there's nothing, or at least there should be, nothing ideological or partisan about helping a community get through a tragedy like this.
No question. I mean, no question about it. Everybody cares about potholes and their bridges and commute times. Let me ask you, there was a New York Times analysis out this morning that found that dozens, this won't be a surprise to you, but dozens of critical bridges across the country lack peer protection systems that make them vulnerable to a ship strike, like what happened here. What needs to be done to ensure these bridges are protected? There's many of them across the country.
Yeah, there's really two things that need to happen. One is the right standards for bridges being built now and going forward. That there has been a lot of evolution, even since 1980, when there was a similar collapse in Tampa, which really prompted a lot of rethinking about how bridges are designed and built. The problem, of course, is bridges in this country are up for 50, 70, mm-hmm. 100 years or more, which means that we're driving on bridges today that might have been designed 100 years ago. And while some of those are being replaced, not all of those are being completely replaced, they need to be reinforced and shored up. So you have a lot of devices or design features that can go around the piers of a bridge where that's a critical support. Mm-hmm. Often you'll hear about dolphins or fenders or islands. Now, I have to say, when you see what happened in Baltimore, there are very few mitigations mm-hmm. that could have withstood a direct impact. In fact, it did have some features that obviously did not prevent mm-hmm. this right now. And I have to say, when you're at the site, as we were again on Friday, in some ways it looks exactly like it does on television. But the one thing that doesn't come across as much on television is the mass of this ship. Mm. It is almost as big as the span of the bridge itself mm. that came down. And when you see it, you see how that was no match for this ship, which is why there's really two things that are being worked on and two things I think we'll learn a lot about from the NTSB investigation. Mm-hmm. Half of it has to do with bridges and how they can be stronger, but half of it has to do with vessels and making sure that this kind of collision cannot happen in the first place. And that's where we are closely watching the NTSB's work. They're independent from us by design for some mm-hmm. very good reasons, but we have an enormous interest in what they find so that shipping can be safer and fewer of these collisions can happen in the first place. They're extremely rare, but the goal, of course, has to be zero.
Absolutely. And this just brought to light all the bridges that need kind of work and repair across the country. I have much more to ask you about. Thank you for sticking around for another block. We have to sneak in a very, very quick break, and we'll be right back.
EV sales are nowhere near what this president wanted or expected. yet the administration continues to shove them down consumers' throats. Why?
Well, let's be clear. Consumers have wanted and purchased more EVs every single year than the year before. Sometimes when these debates happen, I feel like it's the early 2000s, and I'm talking to some people who think that we can just have landline phones forever.
Okay, so you are the master of pushing back on disinformation, I will say. And there is this narrative. I know you're not going to get into campaigns and politics, but there is this narrative being pushed out there a little bit that the years prior to President Biden's administration were better for the economy. How should people be pushing back on that argument?
Well, if you just look at where we were 4 years ago, you couldn't buy toilet paper sometimes. We were dealing with so many issues, not just as a consequence of the pandemic, which hit everybody hard, but even if you look a little bit past that, the economy was growing, but not as fast as it's growing now. Mm-hmm. Unemployment had come down, but not as low it is now. Now, I think it's important to recognize where people are at, too. The country's been through a lot. Families mm-hmm. have been through a lot. And just because a number on a page looks good doesn't mm-hmm. mean people can feel it. Anybody who's been in a relationship knows that if somebody's not feeling great, the first thing you say to them is not, you should be feeling
feel
better
great.
Than you are, right? Stop
yeah.
not feeling it. So, yeah. look, we've been through a lot as a country. Yeah. Having said that, we're also achieving a lot as a country. Mm-hmm. And while there is a very well-funded noise machine trying to poke holes in those achievements, trying to talk down the economy and all of the things America has done, I think it reflects well on the president that the American people under his leadership and the American economy under his leadership have added so many jobs, including importantly in areas like manufacturing, mm-hmm. construction. If you look at the latest above expectations job report, yet another hot jobs report last week, a big part of that came through construction, which I think is linked to us seeing the earliest stages of the construction associated with the president's bipartisan infrastructure package. So I think we need to keep pointing to what's happening and we need to connect the dots mm-hmm. because there's a lot of places where, you know, local and state politicians may not be inclined to give the president a lot of credit for that. You know, for example, red states, the bulk of the funding that a state administration is spending on the roads probably came from President mm-hmm. Biden's infrastructure package, but a governor might not be in a hurry to, you know, slap signage on there reminding everybody about it. So I think, you know, not just as a political matter, but just to remind Americans that there actually are results coming out of legislation being passed when people do in fact work together on a bipartisan basis here, it is important to connect those dots. That's part of why you see me and my cabinet colleagues out on the road all the time. The other thing I've noticed is when something is uncontroversially and unambiguously good, it gets less attention. So we have to go out of our way to connect those dots for people. And again, that's, you know, we have to earn it. We have to make sure people see it by doing the work of laying out those links and recognizing that this is the middle of a trajectory, that we're still working to get things to a better place than we were ever in before.
Let me ask you about something we started the show with Secretary Napolitano, which is just about this notion that, again, I know you're not going to get into campaigns, but Donald Trump is arguing that violent crime is up everywhere and it's a disaster and that he will do better than President Biden. He's meanwhile suggesting he is going to free January 6th defendants, for people who are in jail, January 6th, people who were part of the insurrection. Talk to me a little bit about the contrast here and President Biden's approach to law and order and approach to crime and how it's being kind of misconstrued out there.
Well, again, we got to think about where we were just a few years ago. You know, out this window, you can see Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. I remember what it was like moving here with Jastin and our dogs mm-hmm. and not being able to get that close to the Capitol because it was surrounded with security fencing mm-hmm. In response to the violent attack on that Capitol that the previous president's supporters had just perpetrated. Those were the conditions in terms of security and law and order that President Biden inherited. Mm-hmm. And just in ordinary cities and streets, crime at an elevated level that had begun to happen under President Trump. So we need to talk about the reality here. And again, there is a lot of funding and a lot of energy going into telling a different story, especially on ideological news outlets and online. But the simple facts and the simple reality are right here staring us in the face, including the fact that I can safely walk my dog mm-hmm. to the Capitol today in a way that you couldn't do when we all got here. And also something that you shouldn't have to say it, but let's be clear. If you have been convicted by a jury of your peers for a violent crime mm-hmm. and you were incarcerated, you are not a hostage.
Very important point. to end our conversation on. I really appreciate you being here. Secretary Buttigieg, you can go spend some time with your twins this afternoon, but thank you again. We'll be right back. That does it for me today.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.